Good afternoon, Kansas City, and welcome to this week's edition of Every Woman, coming to you live from Studio A in the world headquarters of KKFI in Midtown, Kansas City. I am your board operator and one of the hosts today, Rachel. I am joined via Zoom by my fellow co-hosts and co-producers, Fiona and Una Nowling. Hi, ladies. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm relaxing at home after a busy day. We were out earlier getting a new washing machine and dryer
because
our previous one is sadly deceased.
Oh, no.
I guess we could say we're out here in Studio N.
Studio N? Studio Pleasant Valley.
Yeah.
Okay. Studio Pleasant Valley.
It could be N for nowhere because we're miles out of the urban core and anything interesting.
You sound like you're very close together, too, because I'm hearing a echo betwixt the two of you. I guess you're sharing the same couch or something.
We have to take it in turns to meet ourselves and gesticulate rudely at each other so he gets to grab the mic.
Okay. That sounds like a good plan. Yeah, well, I'm glad you were successful getting your washer and dryer. I got a text in during Wings today that the main floor drain in our house is backing up and filling the basement up with water. So that's fun. I'll have that to look forward to.
In high swimming pool.
Yeah, that's not the kind of water you want to swim in, however.
Ooh.
Yeah, exactly.
That's bad.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a thing. We'll deal with it. So, Not that, you know, I couldn't talk about my plumbing issues all day, but I would rather talk with our guest today. Our guest today is a woman I admire very much. I have followed her work for many years, and I've found it to be both a comfort and an inspiration for a very long time. She describes herself as a storyteller, a filmmaker, and a musician. She was the lead editor on the Sony Animated Pictures and Lin-Manuel Miranda musical, Vivo, which is now out on Netflix. She also serves as on the executive board of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And during her career in the film industry, she has helped create such Disney films as Lilo and Stitch, Mulan, and Pocahontas. And for DreamWorks, The Croods, Puss in Boots, Monsters vs. Aliens, and Flushed Away. In addition, if there isn't more, but there's still more, but wait. There's still more. In addition to animation and editing, she has written and directed many live-action short films, including the 2012 sci-fi feature called Paradox Alice for Orchard Pictures. Please welcome our special guest, live on Zoom from LA, Miss Mako herself, Erica Dapkowitz. Hi, Erica.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us and taking time out of your busy schedule. We really appreciate
it. Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I adore your new Zoom room or your new studio out there. It's wonderfully purple and filled with all sorts of amazing musical instruments and records. It's fantastic.
Oh, and you're only seeing basically like maybe a quarter or a third of it because there's a lot more going on in areas you don't see. There's like keyboards and other guitars on the walls and stuff. So
I just found out when we were chatting yesterday because I knew that you sang and played guitar and keyboards. I didn't realize you were a drummer as well. That is amazing.
Actually, drums was the first thing I learned.
Oh, wow.
So I was like a little kid, and I begged my parents for a drum set. And, of course, my parents were very reluctant at first because they were worried about all the noise I would make.
Right. Every parent's dream.
And sure enough, they regretted the decision, but they allowed me to have a drum set and take drum lessons.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've dabbled in other instruments. I'm primarily a drummer, but I can kind of play the guitar. I can play, you know, Amazing Grace or something, and any kind of cowboy chord songs like Campfire kind of things, and that's about the extent of it for me. But I'm definitely a drummer at heart. Yeah. So, Erica, I would love to hear a little bit more about your origin story, or like I call your squiggly line story. So if you could tell us, please, how you came to be in this as this amazing person in LA editing films and being an amazing filmmaker.
Oh, gosh. How much time do we have?
We have 54 minutes.
Oh my God, I have to talk really, really fast. No, I just, you know, when I was little, I suffered quite a bit from gender dysphoria, and in order to kind of escape into my own little world and stuff like that, I love storytelling, and I love, you know, any kind of storytelling, whether it's in film
TV, books, or even in music. And so I dove like head first, really fast, into wanting to learn how to like make music, how to make films, like Star Wars, films like Star Wars and E.T. and like those kind of films really resonated with me as a child. Yeah. And just a kind of escaping into your own world with all these different characters, and you could be whoever you wanted to be, kind of a situation. And so I had that goal as like in my single digits of wanting to do that stuff. And so I applied. It took a long time, but I just applied the effort into really wanting to learn everything and get myself into a position where I could create and maybe tell different kinds of stories that I myself just didn't see out there.
Right.
It was really like one of my main goals.
Did you, as a kid, did you like write and tell stories and that kind of thing?
All the time. So, I mean, I literally have a big, like old chest with a lock on it with like just old, kind of like just old pamphlets and things that I used to write even when I was a little kid.
Oh, wow.
Of just stories and going off to far places. And again, a lot of it's kind of focusing around my own gender dysphoria. I just never stopped. Just like, you know, the mediums that I had access to just kept growing.
Right.
So at first it was a piece of paper and a pen or a pencil, and I would learn how to draw. I would learn how to, you know, tell stories. I would read books, and I was constantly digesting other authors or other filmmakers or other musicians and how they were doing things. And I try to deconstruct myself, kind of like taking apart a car and putting it back together again, how they did. I was so infatuated with how these things were put together that I spent most of my childhood and through my teens and into college, like learning a lot of this stuff.
Did you have siblings growing up too?
No, I was an only child. That probably explains a lot.
It does. I mean, apart from the gender dysphoria, which is a whole, you know, another thing, just being alone.
Right.
All the time, and the only mm-hmm. child too is a big thing. Yeah. You sort of need to entertain yourself.
But what's interesting is that I don't really call myself an introvert because I still hung out with a lot of people.
Sure.
Throughout my childhood. So I would hang out with a lot of friends all the time and spend time at their homes and their families and stuff because they all had siblings too, and I would like be like I was like really friendly with even all the girls at the time, and it was never like I never made it kind of a sexual thing.
Right.
I think growing up, I just wanted to be friends with everybody.
But being an only child, you did have peace and quiet at home to be able to work on writing things and
correct.
Not necessarily need a giant chest with a lock to keep siblings out and something from locking things.
Exactly. So, yeah, I didn't have like a little brother or sister coming into the room and like taking my drawings and then like throwing them in the fire pit, you know, kind of situation. I had dogs that came close to doing that, but and my parents were workaholics. So like they would work sometimes 6 or 7 days a week. So I just remember a lot of times like just being alone a lot and just with my own thoughts, and which isn't necessarily a good thing all the time.
Right.
When you're suffering with gender dysphoria, but this helped me cope quite a bit. And, it also helped me just keep practicing and developing, I think, my skills over time.
It sounds like you sort of are self-taught in a lot of this. Have you had formal training in filmmaking, editing, music, any of that stuff?
I would say probably a third of it self-taught, a third of it, you know, I had like private instructors, in terms of like, you know, learning music. I would, you know, make little silly films with friends, you know, on VHS tapes and stuff like that back in the day. And then eventually I ended up going to college specifically for learning how to make film and TV. And so I graduated with a BA in film and television and radio back at Cal State Fullerton. And then I extended that education. I wanted to learn more. I went to UCLA for a little bit to learn more about like film editing and film cinematography specifically.
What is it like at film school? You know, I always have these images of like, you know, a Kevin Smith person who will do anything, whatever it takes to make this movie, you know, give up sleep, give up work, and, you know, sleep on the set, all of that stuff. What is it like?
When you're young, you're like, you have the energy to basically like not go to sleep.
So, like, you know, everybody in that position is constantly, you know, trying to take advantage of the situation and to, you know, and just and pump out, like, what they can do and see what they can do. And you have an enormous amount of resources in those environments, not just from equipment standpoint, but also from personnel, because there's a lot of other students there wanting to also do similar things or at least learn a particular craft. And so it's like, it's a great time to bond with a lot of like-minded people that are trying to do the same things.
Did you went to film school at a very interesting time when, you know, film were, you know, VHS and home camcorders and stuff were coming into vogue and people could actually have a camera at home and not deal with, you know, Super 8 film or whatever. How did that affect your education? As because you saw it go from film to VHS to tapes to DV cameras to, you know, now everyone's got it.
Well, it's amazing. I didn't know, have any of you actually sat down and watched a VHS tape lately? Because,
yeah.
Of course, back then our perspective was, this is amazing,
right.
You know, and then now you look at VHS tape and you're like, I understand why I need glasses now.
I can't see anything.
You know, because it's like, it just looks so blurry and just so, you know, the quality is so poor compared to what we have now. But, you know, even when I went back to film school, I think, like, you know, from when we were doing in-house kind of TV productions, they were usually done on 3/4-inch tape back in the day. And then, of course, with film, it was 35mm film.
Right.
That's what I learned on. There was Final Cut or Premiere or Avid to do, like, nonlinear, you know, digital editing back when I went to college. There just wasn't.
Right.
So I was learning on the old school, like, Mutiolas and Chems back in the day. And, yeah, I'm, like, slicing my fingers with the, you know, the cutting tool and taping everything together. So, yeah, I literally was, that was my education. And as soon as I entered Hollywood and the studio system, like, that's when, like, out of nowhere, like, Lightworks and Avid started to slowly creep into, I think, Pocahontas. They were still mostly, we were cutting on film, but it was still, like, it was the first film where, like, the Avids were starting to come in, and even Mulan, and we were excited just to have, like, a 9-gigabyte chassis. Like, we're like, oh, 9 gigabytes! Oh, right. My gosh, we could fit so much on this 9-gigabyte, like, big hard drive that we would have to, like, shove into the system and then take out. We could never actually put the entire film and have it up at the same time during those early days because it was just too much.
Wow. I want to touch more on that because that is a fascinating thing. I think it's a really cool and unique time to sort of be alive, you know, like we were at the time when, you know, we went from film to tape to digital now. So, but we're going to take our first break of the hour first, and we will come back and talk more with Erica. And welcome back to the Every Woman program. I'm Rachel. I'm joined by Una and Fiona Nowling and our special guest today, Erica Dapkowitz. So I sort of got tongue-tied there because I get so excited about this time because one of my first jobs was as a projectionist in a movie theater, and I learned how to do the changeovers between the two projectors with 35mm film and then eventually cut all of those into the big platters. So I have an inkling of, you know, cutting my fingers on the cutting tool and putting the film together. Do you think that experience was helpful to you as an editor moving forward, or is that just like arcane knowledge now?
I mean, you know, it's a little bit arcane knowledge because of the technology that we now have, but I have a level of respect maybe because, again, that's what I started on, that's what I learned on, and although the tools change over time, the fundamentals are still the same.
Sure.
The concepts of editing and storytelling are still the same, even though technically the tools keep evolving, you know, over the decades.
I guess it's sort of like, you know, I learned how to draft by hand, and then when AutoCAD started to come out and got in my hands, I was like, I never want to draft by hand again, never as long as I live.
Right.
Yeah, but
I think the thing that definitely, though, did do, like, with digital nonlinear editing is it opened up the world of that to people in general around the world. So, for instance, like, film itself was an expensive medium to work with,
right?
Because of all the chemical processing and
the amount of money that often went into post-production for most TV and film that were shot on film. And so most kids or people that were interested in it couldn't really get their hands on it realistically. Whereas nowadays, like most people now, I think actually more so appreciate the art of editing because they're able to do it at home,
right,
for the most part. So they can kind of understand like what it takes to put something together, like Bebo, say, for instance.
I just want to ask you one more question about, because was it Pocahontas that you were talking about where you were, it was the first time you were using the Avid system?
Yeah, so like Pocahontas and then transfer, I went over to Mulan because I was on Pocahontas for maybe about 6 months.
Okay.
It was like my first Disney gig. And so I was kind of brought on as more of a production assistant at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of had me weave in and out of different departments. Like I was a utility PA. And it was a great learning experience because I got a chance to really like dive in there and see what every department does.
Oh, nice.
On a big Disney animated film. And the editorial was definitely one of them. And then I ended up getting into editorial for Mulan like full time and eventually like working my way up through the editing ranks that way.
Oh.
But yeah, it was interesting because at the same time, I would say the technology was changing in terms of, you know, leaving film and going into this like digital world of nonlinear editing. The same thing was kind of parallel happening between traditional animation and computer generated animation.
Sure.
So like Pixar did Toy Story the same year that Pocahontas came out.
Right.
And that revolutionized so many things. And as CG started to become more and more popular, traditional animation and hand drawing started to kind of unfortunately weed away. And so I was almost like involved in that whole transitionary process of seeing the world change in front of my eyes, not only in terms of the editing aspect, but also from the animation aspect of everything.
Yeah, because those are two very, very different looking films.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Tell me how does that work in a hybrid situation where you have stuff on film and then it's transferred digital and you edit it and then it goes back to film again? How does that work?
Well, back in the day, like what they would do is it sounds very archaic, but they would have a camera department.
Okay.
And they would literally shoot everything in the camera department and send it, you know, they would give like a 3/4-inch copy to the assistant editors and then also shoot it to film. So you'd have a film version and you'd have a tape version. And with the tape version, because you couldn't do files at the time.
Sure.
Like they were just, it just wasn't, the technology wasn't there yet. So the assistants would go ahead and import, like in real time, what was shot on the camera. And then we would also get a film version of it. So we would simultaneously have like two versions of the film, one that was being constructed in the Avid, and then the other one that was a film version that we would update per the cut with you know, like an EDL list from the Avid and make sure that we actually had a film version as well. And we did this all the way up until about Lilo and Stitch. Lilo and Stitch was the last film that I physically worked with. I actually worked with 35mm myself.
Wow.
And for our listeners, could you remind people or tell people what an Avid actually is?
So when I use the term Avid, it is just basically a company that has the hardware and the software that helps you put like just terabytes worth of material into its system and basically edit in a nonlinear fashion. If anyone's worked with Premiere, Final Cut, even you know some of them like more simpler programs on your phone, like apps where you can just bring in a couple of your photos and maybe like you know a piece of music and just simply put something together. And Avid is just a really complex tool to be able to bring in like literally tens of thousands of boards and dialogue and music and just try to create a movie out of all the material that's coming in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you miss working on film and doing that sort of thing?
Not really. Just because, you know, back in the day, it was very, like, physically intense. And
sure.
It took a very long time to kind of be able to do things. Now, on that token, it also prevented the directors in the studio from experimenting more in a way too. So it's like having the ability to turn things around a lot quicker with a nonlinear editing system also has made, you know, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, just because you can, you know, should you?
Right.
You know, kind of concept. So it's like sometimes it's a good thing, but I've also seen it abused to the point where it's actually turned films, like it's actually made films come out worse.
Sure.
Because people just can't stop tinkering and constantly second guess themselves. And then to the point where it's like what you had 3 months ago, 4 months ago was a better version of the film.
Yeah.
So I've seen that happen a lot too.
Yeah. It's like, this is great, but what else could it be?
There's a certain discipline, I think, that you need to be successful. Because you could just constantly just keep tinkering and keep second-guessing yourself over and over again.
Yeah.
So there's a certain air of, like, you need to be able to kind of take a step back and go, you know what? Like, I'm confident this is the best version.
Right. That's one of the advantages, I think, of doing theater is that we usually have a very strict opening date. And I always say we never run out of ideas. We just run out of time. It's like, the show's got to open on Friday. You're done.
Yeah.
So you were the lead editor on Vivo, which is just recently released and now on Netflix. Tell me, what does a lead editor do exactly?
Oh, my gosh. What do we not do? It's kind of crazy because it's. I think a lot of people actually really don't know like how much we actually do. So usually lead editors hired right at the beginning of the film. And again, there's differences between an animation editor and a live action editor.
Sure.
So a lot of the times, like in live action, you'll have a script, you know, they'll go and shoot it, and they only like have, say, 3 months or how much time to shoot it. And then that material starts coming in to the editorial department, and the editor starts piecing together scenes and performances and shaping the story based on the material that was shot.
Sure.
In animation, it works a little different because in some ways we're shaping the story even more in editorial because even before anything's kind of animated, we might spend like a year or two with the story department where they're boarding all these individual panels almost like a comic book.
Okay.
And they're constantly, and we're working with story and the directors and the writer on the fly in editorial, like trying to create these scenes and build them in editorial before it ever goes to animation. So, like, I might work on maybe like 80% of the movie that's never seen because there's so many versions that we might go through or try. And so that's why in some ways animation editing is a lot different than live action editing. I always feel like, and I've done both.
Sure.
But I feel like as an animation editor specifically, I'm much more integral to the story making process per se, almost the writing process as opposed to the live action, whereas I'm just kind of dealt with whatever's given to me from the shoot.
Yeah, because it seems like you're almost creating, and you're not really creating the script, but you're saying, wow, wouldn't it be great if this happened, or someone will have a great idea, and you can still explore that idea because it hasn't actually been shot or animated yet.
Oh, it happens all the time. I mean, it even happened on Vivo. Every movie I've ever worked on, there's a large part of me in those films because I was involved directly with the core creative team in creating what is a lot of what you see on the screen in the final product.
So as the lead editor, it sort of implies there's other folks working under you, with you.
It's a team effort. I'm just basically one of the creative leads on a film. There might be like 8 of them total.
Okay.
So if you like, you hear about a director of photography, that's a creative lead. If you hear about the composer, that's a creative lead. The editor is a creative lead, art director, production designer. You know, there's a handful of like creative leads, and we're the ones who are kind of in this pyramid working underneath the main director and the producer, but we're like right underneath them, and then there's like hundreds of people below us that basically report to us and stuff like that. So our main goal is to work with the director and the producer and directly and give them what the best of us and work with them trying to put up this film. And just to go back to what does an editor do?
Yes.
I just described basically the beginning of the film process. Like, I'm in charge of the pacing, the tone, I the character arcs. I'm overseeing the sound design. I'm overseeing the music. I'm one of the last people on the film because I also, as we get to, and I go to all the animation dailies to make sure that the animation's syncing up and that everything's continuity wise looking okay.
Sure.
I go to all the recording sessions with the cast. So like I was there with Lin-Manuel all the time working with him, you know, in every movie I've ever been on, whether it's Nick Cage, you know, or Reese Witherspoon. I work with all these people because as the editor, you know all the skeletons in the closet better than even the directors do. So a lot of the times you're kind of like giving notes and saying like, oh, we need to pick this up, you know, because, you know, we have something slightly different now that's not even represented in what the person's reading in the script.
Right.
And then we're there till the finished film. So I supervise the final mix on Vivo 2 over on the Sony stages. And I worked closely with the Skywalker Sound guys and with Alex Blackamore, who was our composer, and Lin-Manuel, basically music executive, who did a Hamilton too. And I'm basically the one, like, it's almost like an orchestrator. You know, you've got all these people and mixers and engineers and sound designers and sound editors and dialogue editors and music editors and composer. And there's one person that kind of has to orchestrate all this together because I'm the one who best knows the film and right. what the film needs in the end. So that's basically wow. my job.
I guess you were right. Is like, yeah, what don't you do exactly? Yes, it sounds like your fingers are all over all the parts mm-hmm. of that. Is that typical for an editor, a lead editor, to do all that stuff, to be editing the picture and like overview of the final mix of the sound and all of that?
Yes.
Wow.
It's very common. Yeah.
I had no
idea.
And
a lot of it also comes down to like how involved the directors want to be, you know, in that process as well, because directors don't usually like to work, like be in that kind of position. They'll want to get creative notes.
Sure.
But not necessarily like have to be the people to like wrangle it all together and make sure it actually is executed.
Right. Yes. Just go make that happen,
please.
The job
title, if you're outside the industry, does not convey that at all.
No, I
know. People expect the director or producer to be doing the person with the finger in every single pie and doing all that overseeing.
Yeah, and that's not usually normally the case. But again, you know, directors, writers, producers are usually the ones who are, you know, front and center. Yeah. Usually, like, you know, in front of the camera too, in terms of, you know, just it's a little more of a glamorous kind of part of the job in a way, where it's like editors are usually like the most one of the most misunderstood people.
Absolutely.
You know, and quite frankly, almost every director I've ever worked with knows that, and they know that like they're not going to be able to make a good film if they don't have like a really good editor.
Yeah, absolutely.
They know that ahead of time.
So when did the process start for you for Vivo? When did you actually start?
So Kirk called me, Kirk DeMaico, who was the director, and I'd worked with him on the first Croods. And we worked together on Croods 2 for a while over at DreamWorks. We were developing it together. And then we ended up leaving because they shelved the movie at the time. They ended up making it with a completely different set of people.
Gotcha.
After we left. And then Kirk called me and said, hey, I'm over at Sony and I'm going to direct Vivo with Lin-Manuel Miranda. It's an idea, it's a project that he brought to Sony. And he had to do very little sweet talking to me the minute he said Lin-Manuel musical.
Yeah, exactly.
This was back in early 2017.
Okay.
And Hamilton had only like really been out for a couple years.
Right.
And was kind of, you know, this big, you know, big sensational hit.
Right.
So I went over to Sony and I started in 2017 and I'd say for the first year to maybe a year and a half to 2 years, we really were just developing the story and the characters and working with Lin on a lot of the original songs that he had, which eventually most of them were cut from the movie and he had to write new ones because as we were developing the story, it changed and evolved
right
along the way. I mean, the character of Gabby wasn't even in the initial version of the movie.
That's hard to conceive
of. So that's to show you like how much stuff can change, you know, through the process.
So you started this process 4 years ago, and then, of course, mm-hmm. this little pandemic thing happened. How did that affect your production?
I think most of us kind of dreaded that we weren't going to be able to work on the film. Like, right. We were all thinking, like, oh, it's just going to completely stop. But I think all the studios, like, stepped up and tried to figure out a way, especially in the animation world, where we could all work from home. And we're talking, like, you know, some of these films have, like, 500, 600, 700 people. And that's a lot of hardware. That's a lot of equipment. And I would say for the first, I think this, what, it started March 2020 was when this all went down.
Pretty much, yes.
And, you know, they ended up giving me, like, my own Avid at home, and I connected via the internet to the studio, and my whole crew was working from their homes, and we were working in unison and together, and we just got into a rhythm. You know, it was really rough in the first month or two.
I bet.
But we all got into a rhythm of just working this way, and I think I told you at one point, it was the oddest thing, because I had my Avid, which is a fairly large system with multiple monitors and speakers, like, basically perched on my dining room table. I had no other place to put it at the time. And so I joked that I cut Vivo. I made Vivo on my dining room table.
Oh, my God.
Which is the truth.
Wow. What was there a point when everything just sort of shut down, though, that there was nothing happening? Or did they just roll right with everyone sort of working from home?
I mean, again, if it was anything that kind of shut down, it was just because of the couple of weeks of trying to figure out how are we going to do this.
Right.
How can we logistically make this happen? And it was interesting because for the first week, they made almost everybody go home. But they asked me and my first assistant, Amy, to come in and keep working. And we were, like, two of the only people at the studio.
Oh, boy.
And I even remember, like, getting really upset because I would go to the women's bathroom and all the toilet paper was gone. And I would have to, like, hunt down, like, a janitor somewhere and just, like, where's the toilet paper? Do you have it locked up? Because everyone's stealing it, you know, and taking it with them.
Wow.
But it just got to be a point where I think the psychological aspect of what was going on at the time and the unknown and just the world in general was just, like, kind of freaking out.
Yeah.
That it was really difficult to the expectations for us to be at the studio and to not, like, we couldn't be 100%. We couldn't.
Right.
Because we were too worried about, like, what was going on. And there would be times where, like, people would just start opening up my door and I'd freak out because I'm like, you're not supposed to be in here.
Right.
You know, and, you know, that kind of situation. So I think they eventually went, like, yeah, no, we need to start doing this from home.
Oh, wow. Did anything positive happen out of that sort of new workflow that you had to sort of discover on the fly of, you know, working off your dining room table?
On a technical level, the workflow was relatively the same. Okay. I'd say the thing that actually became the most frustrating and to this day is still a problem is having to have these moments of fluidity of on a creative level of being in, like, I can't be in a room with my directors or my story team and all just hashing it out and
right.
And having that fluid kind of, you know, spark happen, you know, kind of on the fly where it's like now, like, you have to do it over Zoom. Mm-hmm. And if everything's structured more because of it and it's just colder. It's a colder environment that doesn't necessarily, in my opinion, kind of support the creative environment that I was used to, and I think most of us were used to. Not to mention, like, I started a new film recently, and I got to say, like, it is much harder than I thought to start up a new film with new people I've never met in person.
Oh, wow.
And to try to develop those relationships is, like, it is way harder than I ever thought
Yes. It
was going to end up being, in a way. Whereas at least with Vivo, we knew each other. Like,
right.
I knew Kirk well. Like, we worked together for a couple of years on the film with the whole crew before we went into COVID lockdown. And so it was much easier to continue those relationships even over Zoom, but starting a new one with, like, all new people and none of us know each other, it's just been a nightmare.
Wow. Yeah, there is definitely... Go ahead, Fiona.
My previous company started having an every other week Zoom call that was a water cooler thing where we could just talk about things about our home life or cool things or even terrible things that had happened to us recently and cat, and that was strongly encouraged. But you'd already got those bonds. You weren't creating them and sharing that stuff in the void with a bunch of strangers.
Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, my experience now, because I've been in COVID with two major studios now, I didn't, of course, the studios are like, they want to keep pumping out the same product in the same amount of time. But I don't think anyone's really considering what you just talked about, Fiona, where it's like a large part of working on these projects or for a company together is that you're kind of together sometimes and you can kind of, you know, go grab a coffee together and just like sit down and get to know each other a little bit better. And I feel like these studios aren't doing a really good job of that. And part of it's, I don't think they care. I think they just want the bottom line, like everybody's a number kind of a thing, and not having the ability to develop those relationships like we're used to has been a real, real problem across the board.
Yeah, Zoom is great because you can see the other person, but there's a level of abstraction that after you've done it for a while, you realize that you're sort of fighting against. And all of a sudden, you get to meet the people in the same room together, and you can communicate the same amount of information about 20 times faster than you can over this medium.
Right. Well, communication in general over Zoom when you're working on like a big feature is already challenging because stuff is constantly falling through the cracks. People are like, oh, I thought you knew that. And it's like, no, you just had that conversation with one other person, but like the other filmmakers know nothing.
Oh, no.
And that happens a lot. And I think because it's a little slower of a process to be able to communicate and do these meetings through Zoom, as opposed to like being in the same location together, at least that's been my experience, then it's like it eats away at like any time that you had like working at a studio environment where you're like all in the same place and you can all kind of like get together, you know, like every 15 minutes and talk, you know, about not even about work. Whereas like you can just talk about family, your friends, what'd you do this weekend? Like, oh, I found this really great restaurant, you know, so, such and such. Whereas like now everything's so ultra structured to fit in within this schedule, a Zoom schedule,
right,
of trying to get everybody together in the same place, you know, at specific times and times, you know, it's like everything needs to be efficient too because of it. So like automatically, if you try to have those conversations, it's like, no, we need to get to business. We have to hurry up. Come on. Like we don't have so much time.
That's very true.
Unless people start structuring unstructured time, which then feels fake and weird, you're not going to get that.
Right.
The amount of stuff I used to overhear by accident when we were physically co-located that was really useful stuff that I needed to know was ridiculous. People have to focus so much more on communication plans and how they actually communicate now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel the same way, Fiona. I feel the same exact way, is that there's so much lost in translation now because of those moments you used to have when you would hear stuff in the hallway. You know, and you talk to people like, oh, did you hear about this? Oh, no, I didn't know anything about it. Kind of situations.
So the film itself got a limited release in theaters, and now it's primarily streaming on Netflix. Do you think the impact of COVID will have a long-lasting effect in how movies are consumed, even, you know, big studio movies?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it already.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just having a massive effect. Unfortunately, you know, for someone like me who grew up, you know, loving the theatrical experience and learning that trade of how to make those films, you know, I made Vivo with the sole intention that it was going to be playing in the theaters.
Right.
You know, that's the way I cut it. That's the way I supervised it. You know, that was the whole point. Even when we did the final mix over at Sony, it was in a massive mixing theater. You know, up on the big screen in a big room. So it's like, that was the intention. And it, you know, it's like, it's sad because visually it's a beautiful film. It's, from an audio standpoint, it's such a wonderful musical, and it's got so much great work done by Lynn and Alex Lacamoire and the Skywalker sound design team that it's like, it's kind of a shame that, like, you know, then all of a sudden you're told, and it wasn't the original plan, you're told, well, we just sold the film to Netflix.
Right.
So while it's nice to be able to know that people are going to be able to enjoy the film in some way, because you're always afraid, like, well, will people ever see it at all?
Right.
You know, kind of a thing. Yeah, it's still a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah. So just before we went on the air, we were talking about how you're now sort of doing press junkets and going around talking about the film and showing the film to people. And you were mentioning that you're one of the few female leads on this project. What is that like working in a, you know, very male sort of dominated environment?
It's a little intimidating. I'm not going to lie. Like I don't think about it too much, but every once in a while, like the light bulb above my head goes off and I start looking around going, I'm the only woman here, you know, like kind of a thing. And that's happened quite a bit at the different studios and the different films I've worked on. I'm what they consider, you know, a creative lead. Mm-hmm. And there's percentage wise, there's very few of us. Usually, like, you might find a lot of female producers or production managers or coordinators, people, you know, women tend to a lot of the times succeed a lot in those more production oriented roles. But when it comes like to the creative side of things, it's still very male dominated. So like even I think at this Q&A that I've been asked to speak at for Vivo in October, I'm the only female there. For it, all the other, you know, creative leads are men.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's.
I was going to say, do you think that that's how women are perceived? Like, women are cooks, but if a male does that, then they're a chef, and it instantly elevates it.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of that. I've also, I think that's definitely a percentage of what's going on. I also believe that there's this interesting internal. I don't think most men realize they're doing it, but I've been in story rooms before where the guys will just they feel so comfortable with each other, but they're acting like guys, right? And they feel uncomfortable if there's like a woman around with how far they can go, but they'll talk about stuff. And then I've literally been in situations where I'll speak up and I'll try to intervene and I'll try to get into the conversation and I'll be like, oh, what about this? What about this? And I've literally had guys shut me down. Like the tone of the moment completely shuts down as if like, oh wait, there's a woman in here still and she's talking, and it's just such an awkward thing. Wow. It's hard to explain. And of course, you know, I think we have to go. Yeah, right. I'll make this really quick. Because I'm trans and because I've experienced on both sides of the fence, I've been in those same meetings before I transitioned as a guy and did exactly the same thing and wasn't treated that way.
Yeah.
So it's definitely because I'm a woman that I've been in situations where other men feel uncomfortable. And I think that's another reason why it's harder for women to get into the creative side of things.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about that on the other side of our second break. So we will be right back after this. And welcome back to the Every Woman program. You're listening to Rachel here, and Una and Fiona are on Zoom, and our special guest, Erica Dabkowitz. During the break, I think Una had something she wanted to bring up. Hey, Una.
You know, I wanted to say that I had a similar experience of having been treated with the difference in treatment. The best way I sum it up is the loss of male privilege, but from a purely scientific side, more of a creative side, being an environmental engineering manager, that. Although I was intersex and trans, and I thought that I understood instinctively for years, I thought that I connected in some way, that I really knew what it felt like to be a woman in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM. It was not until after transition, and thanks to my intersex condition, I had excellent passing privilege, 6 months after transition, when I gave a presentation in a boardroom and I was there in an immaculate skirt suit, I had the perfect solution for the client. I was used to walking into rooms and I was in charge. I was the smartest person in the room. The only question was, how much money are you going to pay me for the answer? And the CEO and the other members smile and nod their head and look at me. And at the end of my presentation, when I literally have laid out the entire solution to all their problems in one PowerPoint I put together on a plane, they turn to my assistant, an intern from college, a male, 19 years my junior and said, is it right what this woman is telling us? Oof-ta. And at that point, I felt the totality of male privilege stripped away from me. And I said, oh, I really have no idea how horrible this is. I felt like screaming. I felt like crying. I felt like taking off one of my heels and throwing at the nearest person. I felt like wanting a hole to open up in the floor and swallow me and pull it in after me. And instead, I had to stand there with a Barbie doll smile on my face and kind of make a joke and say, see, it's so easy. Even my intern understands it. Ha ha, you know. And I know that and have experienced that loss from the technical side, not just creative side. I don't know which would have been worse, actually. I almost think yours might have been more difficult.
Which is interesting because a lot of my, even the stories and the things that I used to make film-wise and video-wise before I transitioned had situations where, like, I assumed I knew that. I knew that there was a difference between the way the world treats men and women. And I even wrote that into a lot of my stories. But still, until you experience it yourself, mm-hmm. and you realize like there is a massive difference, like it didn't, like even then it was still a shock to my system. I got to admit, it was still a shock to my system.
Yeah,
you can't, I thought I was woke as, you know, a stealth intersex trans woman. I thought that I got what my female employees were going through. I thought that I thought I was aware, but until you stand in those shoes and until you are that person, it's, and that's why I tell the especially the older women engineers that I interface with, that I have so much greater admiration and respect for you because you fought your entire life without this privilege. You didn't ask for chemistry sets and were told, you can't do that, you're going to get hurt, here's a doll. You were not told by your peers, by your own family, you can't do that, that's too hard, you should go into this profession. You didn't have to suffer the millions of microaggressions that just became part of the background noise so that you didn't even notice it anymore. And I just have so much mad respect for all of those women that went through that. And I imagine you feel the same.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is my trusted and really good supportive group of women that I've had through my own personal experiences, so often in the very beginning of my transition, I kind of equated maybe some of the things that I was being discriminated against or like had prejudice kind of thrown against me as being a trans thing. And almost every single cis woman said, no, honey, that's not a trans thing. That's a mm-hmm. sex woman thing because we all have gone through it ourselves. And I was just like, really? I'm like, wow.
You hit the nail on the head there, yes.
What sort of things have you had to sort of adapt to and that you've used for personal like coping strategies and things now that you have to deal with these kind of situations?
Well, I mean, it ranges everywhere from, you know, just trying to be more confident in the way that I present myself and trying to speak up in situations. But like I never, again, another shock to the system is I never thought that like I'd be in situations where guys would get aggressive with me. Like I was at one studio and a guy literally threw me up against a wall.
Oh my goodness.
You know, and threatened me for like not agreeing to like work with them on one of their projects. Wow. And that never would have happened to me if I was a guy. Like it just wouldn't have. Like he definitely was trying to impose himself, you know, over me. Yeah. And just being hit on like by executives, mm-hmm. like out of it's like what, and, you know, and being talked to a certain way. I was called bitch. I was like, it's crazy. I could go on and on and on about the things that are just the way people treat men and women differently. And it goes on both sides. Like I've also had some women like not necessarily treat me great because they've even said to me like I would rather work with guys because it's like almost like the queen bee kind of scenario where yeah, like they want to be the only woman in the room and now I'm a threat. to them because it's like now there's another woman in the room. So I've had that situation happen to me.
Me too, yes.
Wow. Yeah, and as a trans woman too, it's hard to parse what where the discrimination is coming from exactly. Is it just because I'm a woman in this environment? Is it because I'm a trans woman in this environment? Yeah, it becomes sort of a double-edged sword that way. So
we have, it takes a little while.
It does.
And you can't let them see you sweat. You have to somehow roll with it. You have to somehow adapt. And even sometimes you metaphorically fall on your own sword and make a self-effacing joke just to get out of the situation. And then you feel terrible and you go to your hotel room afterwards and cry for an hour and fix your makeup and get out and go back to the reception. And
I'm using more tissues than I've ever used in my life sometimes.
Yeah, that whole thing about sort of demurring to the situation and just to get through it is a whole new skill set that I know I wasn't prepared for. So we have reached the end of our time together today rapidly, fantastically. So I just want to thank you so much again, Erica, for joining us today. Literally, we could have talked for another several hours on this, so we'll have to have you back again sometime in the future, maybe after your next project or something. So thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you again for having me, and it was always wonderful talking to you, Rachel and Fiona, Una. Thank you.
Yep, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you to Una and Fiona for joining me and keeping me company here when I was all by myself in the studio. It's always great to see you all. And thank you, our faithful listeners, for joining us for this week's edition of Every Woman. Tune in every Saturday at 3 o'clock for another edition.